Morning by reading Romans chapter 8. Romans 8:5-6. For those who live according to the flesh set their minds on the things of the flesh. But those who live according to the Spirit set their minds on the things of the Spirit. For to set the mind on the flesh is death, but to set the mind on the Spirit is life and peace. Paul points us in this passage to the great battleground, if you will, of the Christian life. For inside of the heart of every Christian lives two mortal enemies, two enemies that cannot be reconciled. They will not lay down their arms, nor can they lay down their arms. In another place, he says it like this. It's Galatians 5, for the desires of the flesh are against the Spirit, and the desires of the Spirit are against the flesh, for these are opposed to each other. They're opposed to each other because they want the same things. They want your life, or they want the same thing, I should say. They both want your life, but they want it for different ends, for different purposes. The flesh wants your life in order to destroy it. The Spirit wants your life in order to restore it to God and give you eternal peace. But like any battle, these two enemies cannot prevail within you at the same time. When one grows in strength, the other one's influence always grows weaker. The desire of the flesh is to destroy. The desire of the Spirit is to destroy the flesh. And the apostle tells us in this passage that you and I play a very important role in this battle. We're the ones, if you will, who are providing food and strength and nutrients to these two enemies. When the flesh is weakened, it's always because of one reason. We've stopped feeding it and fed the Spirit instead. When the Spirit's influence becomes weakened, it's because we've stopped feeding it and fed the flesh instead. Now, how one might ask, how do we go about supplying food and nutrients for these two enemies? Well, the text, I think, tells us pretty clearly. Listen to it again. Those who live according to the flesh set their minds on the things of the flesh. But those who live according to the Spirit sets their minds on the things of the Spirit. It appears that what we think about, that is, the things we set our minds upon, are very important. It could be explained, our thoughts feed these two great warriors. Sometimes our thought feeds one, and sometimes our thoughts feed the other. But it appears that so much of the well-being of our hearts depends upon the very things that we think about. The same apostle seems to make the same connection in another place. Flip over a couple pages, if you will, to Colossians chapter 3. Notice at the very end of Colossians chapter 2, notice how it ends. Okay? We apparently have some people who are aware of this battle within them, and they desire to weaken the flesh. But according to the apostle, they're going about it in the wrong way. They were saying, if you want to weaken the flesh, then you must resist earthly pleasures. Don't touch them. Don't taste them. That sort of thing. But notice what Paul says at the very end of the chapter, the very last part of chapter 2. Yes, those things look and sound really spiritual. He says about that don't touch thing. He says they look and they sound really spiritual and religious, but they're of no value of stopping the indulgence of the flesh. I know these things look and sound spiritual, but they don't weaken the flesh. And then he goes on, and I don't allow the chapter break to make you think that he's changing subjects, because he's not. He just told them what doesn't weaken the flesh, and now he's going to tell them what exactly does weaken the flesh. If then you've been raised with Christ, seek things that are above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things that are above, not on things that are on the earth. For you've died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you will also appear with him in glory. And then after that, he goes into, therefore put to death the deeds of the flesh. Again, Paul tells his disciples the importance of their minds, the importance of what they're thinking about. In passages like these, Christians of the past have based their understanding of a Christian discipline that they call Christian meditation or holy meditation. It's the idea of intentionally focusing your thoughts for a given time on something spiritual for the purpose of disciplining your mind and filling it with the reality of unseen, invisible, eternal realities. Throughout the Bible, we see a very close relationship between our thoughts and our heart. Between the thoughts and the heart. Two things we should see, I want us to see about this relationship between our heart and our thoughts. Okay? I'll tell you a lot of verses. You don't have to flip there. I know Tad will want to write them down, though. Genesis 6:5. Listen to the relationship. The Lord saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was on evil continually. That relationship between the thoughts and the heart. Hebrews 4:12. For the word of God is able to discern the thoughts and intentions of the heart. So again, thoughts in relationship to the heart. 1 Chronicles 29:18. O Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, our fathers, keep forever such purposes and thoughts in the hearts of your people. It's a prayer. Keep these purposes, these thoughts in the hearts of your people. Psalm 139:23. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. And then Jeremiah 4:14. O Jerusalem, wash your heart from evil that you may be saved. How long shall your wicked thoughts lodge within you? These passages, along with many others that we could read, show us that our thoughts are very related to our hearts. They come from our heart. The other thing I want us to see about the relationship between our thoughts and our heart is this. Our thoughts reveal the treasure of our heart. Okay? Matthew 6:21 says, for where your treasure is, there your heart is also. It's really a crazy cycle if we think about it. We think about what we love, and we love what we think about. Maybe a different word would be better. We think about what we feel, and we feel more and more about what we think about. Our thoughts move our affections. They move our feelings. We begin to feel the things that we think. The more we think about certain earthly things, the more we desire earthly things. And the more we sit around and think about how poorly a person treated us,
the more the hatred burns in our hearts for that person. It works like that. There's no fruit that we bring forth in the Christian life, whether good or bad, that doesn't proceed from these thoughts from our heart. Thoughts give the best, listen, your thoughts give the best and surest measure of the health of your heart. As a man thinks, so he is. And as the health of the soil is judged by the things that grow out of it, so the health of the heart is determined by the thoughts that come out of it. Thoughts are the way the heart reveals the treasures that are in it. Every man's heart is a treasury, and the treasure that's in it is either good or evil, just as Jesus says. And there is a good and a bad treasure of the heart. But whatever is in the heart, whether it's good or evil, that's exactly where it is. It's in the heart. So, in light of these things, I have one simple goal for this week and next week's lessons, both. And it's this: to convince us by the power of the Spirit, I want to convince you to spend time thinking about and meditating on holy things so that the Spirit would strengthen our love for Jesus Christ. So, in one sense, meditation, thinking hard about something, is something that we all already do. The problem is, when we do it, we usually are making provisions for the flesh. And as we set our minds on desirable earthly things, usually, okay, even when we set on things about on the things of this earth that we desire, it makes our covetousness for it burn more and more. Sorry, my computer messed up. And as we think and contemplate about the wrongs that people have done to us, it makes revenge burn more and more. We already do these things. Consider how we can work up our emotions to a frenzy just by thinking about things that make us anxious and worried and fearful. I can be laying in the bed and thinking about money or the lack thereof and break out into a sweat and feel like I need to throw up. Like, that's called meditation, but the bad kind. We all do this, and that's why Psalm 19:14 says, "Let the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart be acceptable to you, O God." Because there's a type of meditation that isn't acceptable. So, next week I plan to answer the question of what and how. What do we think about and how should we go about it? But first, this week, I want to answer the question, why? Why do this? What are the motives for this? What good will come of this from thinking about things that are above? Now, it's true, a quick reading of Psalm chapter, the very first Psalm, alone should be enough to convince us that time spent meditating on holy things is a valuable investment of our time. But I'm not going to stop there. I'm going to go on and trust that you will read Psalm chapter 1. There are four things this morning that I want to mention, four benefits that ought to spark an interest in us about this subject if we have the Spirit of Christ living in us. If you don't, then this probably won't affect you. The first benefit that I would tell you, there's four. The first one that I would tell you is that if you were to do this, your faith will be increased and strengthened. That's a pretty good benefit. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for and the conviction of things not seen. Now, if something is observable with the human eye, then it
is then it's not received by faith. Okay? Invisible things, things we can't see, are the proper objects of faith. If you can see it, then it's not faith as the Bible would describe and defines faith. The way we exercise faith is by thinking about things, by setting our mind on things that we cannot see. This is how faith is exercised, and this is how faith is strengthened and increased. The more we think about invisible things, the more our souls will come to find satisfaction in them. The more we'll be gripped by a sense of their reality. The more there's no other way to strengthen faith to any degree but by daily thinking about things that are unseen. Because as long as we don't think of them frequently, we will never believe them sincerely. And I would even say the reverse is true. If you believe them sincerely, they're so great, you will think about them frequently. There are two things that will occur when these thoughts become a treasure in our heart. One, we'll find them ready to rise up in our minds, especially on the occasions when we need them the most. There are seasons in all of our lives when faith and the thoughts of things invisible and eternal are so needful to us that without them we just can't live in the right way. When such times and seasons come into our lives and we set our minds on other things and we choose other things to think of and to seek to find hope in, then we're proving ourselves strangers to this faith. But when the more we think of and find joy and comfort in them, the more our hearts will run back to them during difficult times. So that's the first thing when our hearts begin to treasure these things, is that they'll come to our minds when we need them. The second thing is that they'll become so real to us that we'll continually find ourselves longing to be there. It's why Paul could say, "My desire is to depart and be with Christ, for it's far better." When our hearts come to find joy in these heavenly things and we come to truly desire to be in the full enjoyment of them, that's when faith's work is being done in our hearts, to being done upon us. And the lack of these things is a reason why so many, perhaps even among us, walk around unhappy all their days. So thinking of heavenly things is food for faith. It's how faith is nourished and strengthened, and we should not expect much work anywhere in life. We shouldn't expect much work where there's not proper provision of food for the laborers to eat. And no wonder we might find our faith so weak and faint if we neglect to guide it every day to that which gives it strength. So that's the first thing that it does, is that it will increase and strengthen your faith. There's a second thing. It will give rise to strong and active hope. Hope is related to faith, but it's not the same thing. Hope is a great gift of grace. The scriptures teach that it's through hope that we are purified and sanctified and saved. According to Paul, the beauty of the work that Jesus Christ is doing in our hearts can be summed up like this: Christ in you is the hope of glory. Most of the time when we think of hope, we think of it as an uncertain expectation of a future good which we desire, right? I have some doubt, but I hope so. But the hope that we have
as a gift of grace removes all uncertainty. Because if uncertainty remained, it would hinder the very work that the hope is doing inside of us. So when I speak of gospel hope, I do not mean of uncertainty. It's not, it doesn't look good, but I hope so. Gospel hope is a fruit of confidence. We don't hope because we doubt. We hope because of confidence, because we're confident. The reason hope is such a valuable gift to Christians is because it's given to us to support us and to comfort us and to refresh our souls during trials. When we're weary and despondent, hope gives an expectation of a speedy entrance to glory, and it also creates in us an earnest desire for that glory. Now, the reason people aren't benefited by this hope more than they are is because we give so little time thinking about the things that we hope for. Now, unless we give ourselves intentionally to setting our minds on eternal things, then it's impossible that it should be the object of our hope should be strong and active, that it will create a strong and active hope. Consider this illustration with me. Suppose you have a group of people going on a trip to a remote country. All of them have been told that this place is a place of rest and an inheritance is provided for them. With this information, they all put themselves to voyage. They all want to go and possess this country. However, some of them have only a general idea of these things. They know nothing in detail concerning them, and they're so busied about with other things that they have no interest to inquire further into them. And they're content to go on with just these general hopes and expectations. Then there are others who by all possible means seek to know more and more about this country. Particularly, they want to know things like the nature of the climate where they're going. They want to know something of the inheritance that's going to be theirs. They want to know something about the food and all the delights that await them there in that country. Their trip proves long and wearisome. There are difficulties many, there are dangers great, and they have nothing to relieve and encourage themselves with but the hope and expectation of the country where they're going. Those of the first group will be very prone to give up. Their vague hopes will not be able to relieve them. But those who have a better understanding of the state of things and of life where they're going and of the greatness of their destination are always better equipped to cheer their minds and their hearts when troubles come. So, in this journey of ours as we march towards a heavenly country, we know that we're sure to meet all types of dangers, all types of difficulties and hazards. And it's not a vague understanding of the blessing that awaits us that will excite us and work spiritual hope in us. But when we think and meditate on heavenly things, that's when grace will give rise to a strong and active hope. I was thinking about that this morning, in terms of our study through the Pilgrim's Progress a couple years ago, and just the number of times throughout the story that Bunyan stops and tells us about how the pilgrims start talking about, thinking about, tell me about the city where we're going. Tell me about the celestials. What do you know? You've been close to it. You've seen it. Tell me about it. I think Bunyan knew the types of things that we're talking about this morning, how visions and thoughts of that place would stir our hearts to want to be there. Increase our faith and increase our hope. That's the second thing that it will do. It will give rise to strong and active hope. There's a third thing. It alone, okay? I want to make sure we remember what I'm talking about. Thoughts of eternal glory, putting our mind on unseen, invisible, eternal things alone will prepare you for life sufferings. Life is hard. To live on this earth is to suffer. And if you're not in the midst of a hardship right now, then just wait, because it's coming. There's nothing more necessary for us during those seasons than to have our minds furnished with such things that will prepare you when suffering comes. And I tell you today, nothing is more useful to that end than constant thoughts of eternal things and future glory. From these blessings alone can the soul be prepared to handle all sorts of sufferings. And it's exactly what the Apostle Paul does and tells us time and time again in his letters. Specifically in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, is first, verse 16. He tells us why he doesn't lose heart. So we do not lose heart. He was just going through the troubles that he was going through. Though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. For this light and momentary affliction is preparing us for an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison, as we look not to things that are seen, but to things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal. Here the apostle is telling us he lays on in one scale and considers all of his sufferings to be light and momentary. And then he lays glory on the other scale and finds it to be weighty and eternal. In one is sorrow that he says is for a little while. In the other one, eternal joy. In the one, pain that he says for a few minutes, for a few moments. And the other, everlasting rest. In the one is the loss of some few temporary things, and the other is full of the fruit of God in Jesus Christ, who is our all in all. He says the same, he compares the same things. Tells us the fruit of his meditation in chapter 8 of Romans. He says, "For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not even worth comparing with the glory to be revealed to us." The eternal inheritance has become such a reality to Paul that he's convinced that it's infinitely greater than all the sufferings that he could endure in this life. He's so filled with the glories of the heavenlies that they cushion and make light the sufferings of this present life. In his mind, the eternal riches are so much more than the present suffering that it takes away all that the suffering could do to make him complain and fills him with thankful joy. This can only happen as we turn our eyes off of the world and earthly things and fix them upon things that are unseen, invisible, but eternal. The only people who can endure suffering and still be described as rejoicing with joy that is inexpressible and filled with glory are people who have been fed every day on the fact that they have an inheritance that is imperishable and undefiled and unfading, kept in heaven for them by God's power. The only way to be prepared is to set our mind on things that are above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of the Father. The apostle gives us another illustration for this encouragement in a comparison with earthly things. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 25. He says, "Every athlete exercise self-control in all things.
They do it to receive a perishable wreath, perishable crown, but we an unperishable. If men are willing to go through the pains of training in order to receive a corruptible crown of human honor and human applause, and in the middle of their hardship, the thoughts of this honor and human applause is enough to keep them going on and not give up, and it's grounded uncertain. They do all this training and they could lose and not get their crown. Shall not we who have an imperishable crown that's promised to us by a God who cannot lie, shouldn't we cheerfully undergo and endure suffering? This alone will prepare you to suffer. Suffering will come. This alone will prepare you for it. There's a fourth and final thing. This is the most effective way to wean your heart from the things of this world. The most effective way to wean your heart from the things of this world is to set your heart upon the things of another world. In Luke 14, verse 26, Jesus says, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple." Now, I believe Jesus is speaking comparatively here, not absolutely, comparatively. What I mean is, our love and devotion to him and to his gospel should be so much more than our love and devotion to even our most cherished earthly possessions. As Paul would say, they're not even comparable. This is exactly what our Father desires to do in us. He will not share the heart of his disciples with any earthly thing. He desires all of your heart. And because he knows not only that he's worth it, but he also knows that this is the best thing for all of your earthly relations. You can relate to the things of this world so much more rightly and purely only if we're loving God supremely. And yet here we find such a weakness in our faith. We are people who cleave to the dust. Our affections are so inclined to earthly things. Again, I go to the words of the apostle. He said that if he had his choice, he would rather leave this world and be with Christ. He also said that he counted everything in this world, everything that this world had to offer, as loss. I count it all as garbage, it's rubbish, compared that he might gain Christ. And I believe he's told us how he came to that point, how he grew to that point. How he got there. He came to see unseen, invisible, eternal things as more valuable than things of this earth. He instructed us, set your mind on things that are above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. He said, if you want to stop the indulgence of the flesh, set your mind on things above. If we want our hearts to treasure heavenly things, we must feed it with heavenly thoughts. If we want our flesh to grow weaker in regard to its love of earthly things, then we must starve it from earthly thoughts. If we want our heart's grip on earthly things to be weakened, we must feed it something else. In 1647, Richard Baxter began writing a book called The Saints' Everlasting Rest. It's one of his best works. He wrote most of the book when he was far from home, and the only source that he had to use was his Bible. He was ill for many months when he was away. He was expected to die several times. He was on his deathbed. And at that point, he decided that he was going to fix his thoughts on the believer's eternal rest in Christ. And the result was over 750 pages of meditations on unseen things. Listen to what a couple men of his own generation said about it, his book. Again, remember, we're talking about how it weans our hearts from the things of this world. William Bates wrote of this book, "To allure the desires, he unveils the sanctuary above and discovers the glories and joys of the blessed in the divine presence. By a light so strong and lively that all the glittering vanities of this world vanish in comparison. And a sincere believer will despise them as one of mature age does the toys of children." Another minister, John Janeway, said that his conversion was greatly influenced by reading Baxter's book. Imagine somebody who's not even a believer reading a 750-page book on heaven. Like, yeah. Referring to the part of the book that explains heavenly contemplation, Janeway wrote to a friend, "There is a duty which, if exercised, would dispel all cause of melancholy. I mean heavenly meditation and contemplation of the things to which the true Christian religion tends. If we did but walk closely with God a time every day in this duty, oh, what influence it would have upon the whole day besides and upon the whole life. This duty, with its usefulness, manner, and directions, I knew some measure before, but had it pressed upon me by Mr. Baxter's Saints' Everlasting Rest, a book that can scarce be overvalued, for which I have cause to bless God forever." Brothers and sisters, these are some of the benefits of holy Christian meditation. And I hope that we've seen our need. I hope that they have gained some interest in your hearts. If so, next week I will continue with the same subject and we'll look at the objects of meditation and how to do it. So, why don't you pray with me? Father, I pray simply that you would work in our hearts and that the words of our mouths, meditations of our heart, would be acceptable in your sight, O God. Amen. You can be dismissed.